We are continuing our study in the 9th Psalm. Last time we had gotten through the 8th verse. The writer of this psalm, whom we believe to be David, is giving God praise because God has destroyed the enemies of his people. And he's also, as he does this, showing the character of God as God deals with his enemies and as God deals with his own people. Any further, before the psalm is over, we'll ask God to give him help for future times of trouble, for future enemies that may come upon him, or even present enemies that have yet to be overcome. We're in that portion of the psalm in which he's given the character of God, in which he shows how God deals with those that are not faithful. And this is extending from verse 7 through verse 12. So let's begin reading with the 7th verse. But the Lord shall endure forever. He hath prepared his throne for judgment. Showing there that God is not going to be temporary, that God will not be overthrown or destroyed like the enemies are going to be, and like they have been, but he is going to endure forever, and he has prepared his throne for judgment. That is, he is going to be in a position to judge and will judge all mankind. Verse 8 says, and he shall judge the world in righteousness. He shall minister judgment to the people in uprightness. A clear prediction of God's position as judge. He's going to judge the world. He's going to judge all persons, all people, all nations. He's going to judge them in righteousness. It'll not be a partial judgment. It'll not be one that's based upon false information or one that's based upon improper rules and standards, but he's going to judge them in righteousness. Everybody will be required to meet the same standard. There'll be no favoritism in the judgment. He shall minister judgment to the people in uprightness. So he's going to be the right kind of a judge in order for true justice to be done. But as we further study this character of God, we see in verse 9 that another element to this great nature of God. Not only is he going to be a righteous judge that's going to minister judgment to the world, but he says in verse 9, the Lord also will be a refuge for the oppressed, a refuge in times of trouble. Now this word for refuge means a high place. That is, it's going to be some kind of a place of safety or security, a place to which those who need it can go and have protection from their problems. A refuge for the oppressed. And this word oppressed means the crushed or the broken. Those that have been trodden down. Those that have received bad or improper treatment at the hands of their fellow men. These are the ones that the Lord will be a refuge for. This Lord, who is the great judge. This Lord that will set up his judgment seat and cause the wicked element of the world to have great fear and trembling. This is the same one that these crushed or oppressed or broken people can come to for a refuge. He will be a high place for them. He will be a place of security for them. And that verse 9 further says, a refuge in times of trouble. Not only then does this include those that have been oppressed and crushed and broken, but it includes all those who are in trouble. And of course this can include all mankind. We do not have to have somebody to necessarily put us down, to really put us in a state of jeopardy before we can use God and need God by being accounted among those who are in trouble. All who seek after God for help, all who will turn to him, he is a refuge for them. And so the other side of God's nature then, besides being the great judge, he also then is the succorer of those who have need. He is the one to whom we can all turn for help when we have need. So no wonder David says here in the first verse, I will show forth all of thy marvelous works. I will be glad and rejoice in thee. I will sing praise to thy name, O thou most high. This is a God that regardless of how low we are, how downtrodden we may be, how humble we may be, we still can approach this God and he welcomes our coming to him. He is our refuge. And verse 10 elaborates upon this further. And they that know thy name will put their trust in thee, for thou, Lord, hast not forsaken them that seek thee. Now they that know thy name, these are those that are acquainted with God. Those that know God, that know his true character, his true nature, they then are the ones who are going to put their trust in him. And so it seems then that the more knowledge we have of God, the more trust we're willing to put in him. And those who do not trust God, those who do not place their confidence in him, do not do so because they are ignorant of God. They do not know the true nature of God. And we see here that there must be a knowledge of God before we can even be able to trust him. You know, these problems that we're talking about, these times of trouble, these who are oppressed. Their situation is a very, very real one. It's not just some kind of a mock or make-believe time of trouble. Their very well-being is in jeopardy. Maybe their lives are in jeopardy. Their souls are certainly in jeopardy. And to place this great trust in God in these times of trouble, it requires a lot of faith, requires a lot of believing that He is and that He will do the things that we read that He will do. And so we must know Him. The more we know Him, the more knowledge we have of Him, then the more we're able to put our trust in Him. The more we see how He operates, the more we see how that God actually functions, the better we're able to really trust Him and to place our true confidence to totally commit ourselves into His care. And one of the benefits of studying the Bible, and in particular this book of Psalms, is that we learn more and more about the character of God. We learn how God does function, how God does operate as He deals with men. And the more we learn about this, then the more we're willing to trust Him, the more we're able to trust Him. And so He says, "They that know Thy name will put their trust in Thee." So let's become acquainted with God. Let's learn more about the nature of God. Let's learn more about the true character of God, so that we then can be able to trust Him. We won't be able to trust Him if we don't know Him. And He further concludes in verse 10 by saying, "For Thou, Lord, hast not forsaken them that seek Thee." Now those that do seek after God, those that are true followers of God, are going to find that God does not forsake them. That's another part of His character. God never forsakes. First, it's always man that does the forsaking. And when we forsake God and we turn to something else, then God will forsake us. But He does not forsake those that seek Him, those that are actively seeking after Him, those that are actually following Him, those that are actively doing His will here upon this earth. God does not forsake those. God is faithful to those. God continues to guard and protect and be a refuge for those. And so that's another quality of God that we must realize, that when we seek Him, He does not forsake us. He will stay with us. He will continue to be our guard, our protector, our guide, and as verse 9 says, our refuge. Verse 11, "Sing praises to the Lord which dwelleth in Zion." Now as a result of this great character and nature of God, which allows us to put our trust in Him, the more we know Him, the more we're willing to trust Him, the more we're able to trust Him, this character of God which causes them to not forsake them that seek Him, then the psalmist says to sing praises to the Lord which dwelleth in Zion. Let's glorify His name. Let's give Him the honor, the praise, the glory that He deserves to have as a result of this. This is one of the very great qualities of His nature that man cannot afford to overlook. Sing praises to the Lord which dwelleth in Zion. And this phrase, "dwelleth in Zion," refers to the fact that at that time, the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant were the place where God dwelled. This was the local habitation of God in the spiritual realm. And so this was a holy place. Later the temple was built here, and this was the dwelling place of God. So we're talking about this God that dwelleth in Zion, not some other God, not some other fictitious imagination, not some kind of a spiritual being that a man has concocted out of his own ideas, but this is the God that dwelleth in Zion. And He further says in verse 11, "Declare among the people His doings." That is, broadcast the news. Give the good report what this God does. Tell more about His character. Tell more about His nature. For we who are followers of this God, we're very pleased with His nature. We're very happy to tell what He does and what kind of a character He has, because this is something that's in our favor. This is something that is designed to be conducive to the comfort, to the safety, to the security of all men everywhere. So tell about this. Declare among the people His doings. And certainly that should be one of our qualities today, that we're willing to talk about this God among the people. We're willing to tell about His doings. We're willing to tell about the kind of a nature and character that He has, so that all mankind will have the opportunity to take advantage of serving this great God. In verse 12, He concludes this description of the character of God. And He gives a wonderful contrast in the very nature of God in this 12th verse. He says, "When He maketh inquisition for blood, He remembereth them." Now, God is pictured here as the one who does make inquisition for blood. He is the great judge. And this seems to refer to the fact that God does not let the shedding of blood go by without Him noticing it, without Him remembering it. and he makes an inquisition. That is, he inquires about it. He passes judgment upon it. And this seems to refer to the basic law given back in the 9th chapter of Genesis, Genesis 9, beginning with the 5th verse. There that says, "And surely your blood of your lives will I require. At the hand of every beast will I require it, at the hand of man. At the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by a man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God made he man." So God has a law now about this shedding of blood. And he requires that when blood is shed, that there be some kind of an accounting for it. So he is the one then that does make this inquisition about it. But just as we can picture God then as the great and terrible judge, who is constantly on the alert to make inquisition for those that would shed blood, then we all have to also remember that he also remembers those that are his people, those that are the poor and the humble and the afflicted. For he says in the last of verse 12, "He forgetteth not the cry of the humble." And that word there for humble means the afflicted. Those that are in this state of trouble. Those that are oppressed or crushed. And so we see then a double nature of God. It's not a conflict in God at all, but it just includes the all-encompassing features of God. How that he, on the one hand, is the terrible judge that makes inquisition for blood, or for the shedding of blood. But yet he, on the other hand, does not forget those that are his people. He remembers the poor, the humble, the afflicted, those that are in some kind of trouble. So God then can carry on both types of characters at the same time. While he is seeking out those that need to be punished, those that need to be given some kind of retribution for their wicked deeds, he at the same time remembers those that need to be given refuge, and those that are his people, so he remembers them. He forgetteth not the cry of the humble. So it's a very wonderful element of God. We as mere mortals here have a hard time filling two capacities like this. On the one hand, being the terrible avenger of the of a crime of some kind, and yet on the other hand, showing so much mercy to those that are afflicted and crushed and that need our help. But that's the very nature of God. Just as he does not ever let down on his position as being the judge, he also then does not forget those that have the cry for help directed to him. Now in verses 13 and 14, the subject changes a little bit. The writer is telling God that he still needs help, although God has already delivered him from some really terrible predicaments. God has already passed judgment upon his enemies. Still, there are present problems, and there are yet future problems to occur. So he is telling God that he still needs to have his help. He begins by saying in verse 13, "Have mercy upon me, O Lord." He's asking God to extend his great forgiving nature to him, to forgive him of his sins, so that he then can be in a position to receive the blessings of God. "Have mercy upon me, O Lord. Consider my trouble which I suffer of them that hate me." So he still has those that are hating him, those that are opposed to him, those that are threatening him, those that are putting him in a state of jeopardy. And this is his trouble. And he asks God to consider my trouble. Look upon the trouble that I'm having. Think about this. Consider this. Put some thought into it so that you are able to truly sympathize with me and you truly know what my position is, what kind of problems I have. Consider my trouble which I suffer of them that hate me. Now, this is not just trouble that David might have gotten himself into because of his own ignorance or his own failure to follow the will of God, but this is brought on upon him by those that hate him. That's the trouble by those that hate him, the trouble that are that is brought by those that are opposed to God. And so we then find that it's proper for us to ask God to consider, to think about, to put some thought into, to put some effort into my predicament, my situation. Not only do I think about it, not only do I consider what maybe needs to be done or what kind of problem I'm in, but it's proper for me to ask God to consider, for God to think about it also. Them that hate me, thou that liftest me up from the gates of death. Now here he's describing what God has already done for him and then what God is also able to do at this present time. To lift up from the gates of death is an allusion to the fact that death is a habitation that is in an enclosed area. It is the dark underworld. It is one that is entered into only through these gates. And God controls this ability to go into death and out of death. And so he described himself as being one that's been lifted up from the gates of death. Here I'm at the very brink of death. Death is all around me. One time David made this statement whenever Saul was so definitely persecuting him and pursuing him. So he describes his condition as being one that's been right down to the very brink of death, but you've lifted me up from the gates of death. Then in verse 14, he further elaborates upon this by showing what his condition is once God has rescued him from death, that I may show forth all thy praise. You've let me live so that I can continue to praise thee, so I can continue to worship and to serve thee. You know, sometimes we think that God maybe has relieved us of a lot of our problems, but we forget that he relieves us so that we can continue to serve him, so we can continue to worship and to praise him. It's not so that we can just kind of shrug our shoulder and say, well, now I don't have to worry about that anymore, but we have an even greater duty to God now. So this is that I may show forth all thy praise in the gates of the daughter of Zion. Now, the gates of the daughter of Zion, of course, would be the gate of the city of Jerusalem. And it is considered that the gates of a city were the place where public concourse was carried on. This is where the elders would meet many times. This is where a man came for judgment. This is where commerce was done. And so it was a place of life, a place of exuberance. And so he talks about then being able to be relieved and saved from the gates of death so that he could then be in the gates of the daughter of Zion or the gates of Jerusalem and there show forth all of his praise. Regardless of who was there, the general gathering of the public, the coming and goings of commerce, he would be there to show forth the praise of God at that place. Now this also lets us know that this psalm was written sometime after Jerusalem became the capital city of the nation of Jerusalem. So it was written not during the time of Goliath, as some seem to think, but it had to be after David had made this city of Jerusalem the city of Zion, or where Zion was located. And he concludes verse 14 by saying, I will rejoice in thy salvation. The very fact that you saved me, the very fact that you have pulled me out of this depth of great danger and distress, then I'm going to rejoice in that. I'm going to rejoice because of that. My joy will reflect what you've done for me. And sometimes we may ask ourselves the questions, does our action reflect what God has done for us? Are we conducting ourselves in such a way that we are reflecting the salvation God has given for us, that we have, or that we are showing to others the great relief, the very snatching from the gates of the grave, as it were, that God has done for us? Or do we, once God has given us a great blessing like this, do we not let it be known? Do we just go on and hide it as though maybe we'd done this all on our own, or just some kind of a chance that happened to us and didn't come as a result of God interposing for us? So that's the thought that's given here. I'll rejoice in thy salvation. And not only that, though, but he still is asking God to have mercy on me. Consider the trouble which I suffer. He still is in a state of trouble. So he's really calling upon God to save me now like you have done in the past. Continue to give me thy great benefit, thy great blessings now in my present state, like you have in my previous state when I was needing thy help so desperately. In verse 15, the writer, David, gives a description of his foes. He tells what their condition is. He says, the heathen are sunk down in the pit that they made. Now the word here for heathen really means the nations. We're talking about those idolatrous people that surrounded David, those that were opposed to God and the things of God. And he describes them as being sunk down in the pit that they made. Now there are two schools of thought here about this. Is he talking about those foes of his that have already been destroyed and that have already been overcome by God? Or is he talking about his present foes, ones that have yet to be overcome, but David is so confident in God that they're going to be overcome, so confident that God's going to give him the victory, that he can now speak of this as though it's already happened? And it's real difficult to know exactly what the sense is. But the condition of his foes is this. They are sunk down in the pit that they made. In other words, they made a pit. They dug a pit so that they could trap David, or so that they could trap their enemies, or the ones that they were oppressing. And as they made this pit, it turns out that they fell in their own pit. They were sunk down in the pit that they had made. And of course, this is one of the great characteristics of God, that he does take the devices that man makes to go against him, and he uses these devices to overcome his enemies, overcome the ones that do not love him. So in this particular case, these heathen had dug a pit for David, yet they fell in their own pit. And he further says, in the net which they hid is their own foot taken. So they had set a net here, which would be like a trap net, and they had hidden this net, wanting to take someone else in it. But they then were captured, they were trapped, their own foot was taken in the net that they set for someone else. And as we say, this is one of the very great ways that God uses to overcome his enemies. He lets them make their own devices. He lets them come up with their own plans and their own imaginations. And then God uses these things to trap them with. He uses these things to overcome them with. And so it is truly one of the wondrous natures of the miraculous ability of God to be able to take man's most cunning devices and use them against him, so that he then is taken in his own trap. And that's the way David expresses this about his enemies. And if we'll notice the dealings that God has with us, many times those that are so opposed to what is right, we find that they are trapped by their own devices. This is one of the ways that God has of putting the enemies at a disadvantage. Well, we're going to close at that point. Remember, we still like five verses finishing this ninth psalm. So next time we'll begin at the 16th verse. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.